Good to see everyone this morning, especially visitors. If you have your Bible open, follow along, and most of the passages that we have for this morning will be on the screen as we go through them. And if you have any questions, be sure to ask them. We welcome those. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 13 is a passage that I have used as a text before in a different sermon with almost the same title, but a little bit different approach. It says here in verse 10, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall be dissolved with fervent heat, and the earth and the works that are therein shall be burned up. Seeing that these things are all thus to be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in all holy living and godliness, looking for and earnestly desiring the coming of the day of God, by reason of which the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. But according to His promise, we look for a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwelleth righteousness." Now, there's going to be a time when this world is going to come to an end. It is referred to as the judgment day in verse 7, where He says, "But the heavens that now are and the earth by that same word have been stored up for fire, being reserved against the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men." Now, who in the world would look forward to such a time as the destruction of the world? I grew up under the cloud of mushroom, you know, the mushroom cloud. Everybody's building storm cellars but us. And I kept begging my dad to build a storm shelter or a bomb shelter. Bomb shelter is what I meant. A bomb shelter. And he wouldn't do it. And it had something to do with not owning the house or something like that. But anyway, I thought, what a neat place to play. And in case they dropped the bomb, you know, we'd be safe. But of course, that didn't happen. But yet. But anyway, the point is, who looks forward to and anticipates the day of the destruction of the world? Here are some people in this passage who look forward to and earnestly desire the coming of that day. And the first thing you think of, you know, if we weren't talking about the Bible, you'd think, well, those are crazy people. And then when you start putting it in a biblical context, then there's a lot of people say, see, I told you, they're crazy people. Who looks forward to the end of the world? Well, the person who is the kind of person that he needs to be. We need to get ready for that day, because if we're ready, then that day is not going to be the big shocker that it is for everybody else. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 1, Paul says, "But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, ye have no need that aught be written unto you, for yourselves know perfectly that the day of the Lord so cometh as a thief in the night, when they are saying peace and safety, and then sudden destruction cometh upon them, as travail upon a woman with child, and they shall in no wise escape. But ye, brethren, are not in darkness, that day should overtake you as a thief, for ye are all sons of the light, the sons of the day, and we are not of the night, nor of darkness." We know what's coming. We know and can anticipate the coming of the day of Jesus. And so we can get ready and we can anticipate it. But let's be a little bit more specific about this. Instead of just talking in general terms of those who are ready, those who know what's going on, what kind of people are they? What does the Bible tell us that we need to be in order to be that kind of people? And that's basically where we're going. And as we progress, you will see that we're concerned chiefly with one particular area in our study this morning. That is mainly one particular area. And let's look at it. First of all, in specific cases, we need to be the kind of husbands that we ought to be, those of us who are husbands. In 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7, 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, Peter says, "Ye husbands, in like manner dwell with your wives according to knowledge." That means like you know you're supposed to. You know, a lot of men know what they're supposed to do, but they don't do it. And the reason they don't do it is they can get away with not doing it. But you dwell with your wife the way you know you're supposed to dwell with your wife. You treat her the way you know you're supposed to. He goes on to say, giving honor unto the woman as unto the weaker vessel, as being also joint heirs of the grace of life, to the end that your prayers be not hindered. You want to go to heaven? You want to be able to talk to God? We'll never get to the point where you can't talk to your wife. When you can't talk to your wife, think how difficult it is to talk to God, who holds you responsible for what you say to your wife. There's other passages that we need to look at. One is Ephesians chapter 5 and verses 25 through 33. And hopefully this will be fresh on the minds of all newlyweds in the audience. It was read at their wedding, interrupted only by the emergency sirens from across the street. But anyway, well, the wedding was across the street from the fire station. No, I'm not going to say how appropriate. But anyway, I guess I just did. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, it says, husbands, love your wives. Now that is husbands, agape your wife, not husband, eros your wife. Agape and eros your wife. Agape is a more general term for love, but it is a love that in the Scriptures is an unrequited love, is one that's not necessarily answered. You love, you have affection for, but more than it's more than affection. You have concern for. Your desire is unto your wife that she do well, that everything good happens to her. Okay, it's not limited. It certainly, and sometimes it doesn't even, in fact, most time it doesn't include sexual relations. Husbands, love your wife. And in some people's minds, that's the only way they love their wife, is through erotic love. And that's wrong. That's wrong. But in this context, it says, husbands, agape, or love your wives that way, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for it. Now notice, he loved the church and he gave himself up for it. And that's how husbands are to love their wives, to be ready to give themselves up for their wives, to spend their energies, their time, their efforts, their desires, their aspirations, to benefit their family, especially the wife. He says that he might sanctify it, having cleansed it by the washing of water with the word. The idea of sanctifying the wife is setting her apart. That he might present the church to himself a glorious church. The man ought to be have such a relationship with his wife that she is a glory to him. He's proud of her. He's glad to be with her and anxious to see her. That he might present to himself the church a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. Even so ought husbands also to love their own wives. Agape again there. He that loveth his own wife loveth himself. For no man ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as Christ also the church, because we are members of his body. Now think, we're still talking about agape love beginning in verse 31. He says, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. What is he talking about? He's talking about agape love. He's not talking about erotic love necessarily. Might involve that. That might be a benefit or a fruit of it. But he's talking about more than a sexual union. He is talking about a union of two people and all that involves those two people. And this is what's wrong with a lot of marriages. A lot of marriages begin on the assumption that the two becoming one flesh is they just have sex. If that's all that it is, it ain't much. But anyway, he says, this mystery is great, I speak in regard of Christ and the church. We are one flesh with Christ in the church. Nevertheless, do ye all severally love one, each one his own wife, even as himself, and let the wife see that she fear her husband or respect her husband. That's a tall order for a man. It demands a lot of energy. It demands a lot of time and effort. Maintaining a good relationship in a marriage is hard work for the man, and he needs to be willing to put in that hard work. In 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8, we find that man's responsibility to his wife, as well as his children, is named. It says, but if any provideth not for his own, especially his own household, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. The specific application goes elsewhere. It talks about taking care of elderly relatives, but it's given in general terms so that it includes those who belong to us, our children or our parents or our husband and wife. If any provides not for his own, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And now, the key to all of this, and the key to any relationship, maintaining the proper place in any relationship, is found in Ephesians chapter 5. Now, I've got verse 22, but that should be verse 21. Should be verse 21. So if you've got an outline, mark it down. Where it says, subjecting yourselves to one another in the fear of Christ. The husband subjects himself to his wife. The wife subjects herself to him. And children subject themselves to their parents, but at the same time, the parents subject themselves to the children. In what way? We don't live selfishly. We live with the other person in mind, with their desires, their benefits, their welfare, ahead of ours. That's the key to any human relationship that is going to be acceptable to God, especially in the family. But we live in a time when people are in it for themselves. And they think in terms of what benefits me and how I feel about it and what I need to be doing with my life. And everything is all about them. Well, on the day of judgment, it won't be. It'll be different. Now, what manner of wives do we need to be? What kind of wives does God expect? We stay in Ephesians chapter 5. And this may not make you happy, but I'm just going to read the text and you can get it. The reason I'm just going to read the text is because it says it all. Wives, be in subjection unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, being himself the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives also be to their husbands in everything. Now, husbands, that doesn't mean that your wife is a dummy. You want to know the real sorry secret about that I've been keeping all my life? Is that most women are smarter than their husbands. I mean, how smart do you have to be to sit in front of a television watching guys chase a pumpkin around the pasture eating nachos and drinking soda pop? The pumpkin being a football. Who has the intelligence and the patience to put up with the children all day? Who has the intelligence to make the man feel like he's Superman when he's Barney Fife? Women are smart, fellas, and we need to recognize that. Some of the smartest people I have known, especially when it comes to scriptures, are women. And now, that doesn't mean men are stupid. Some of us are pretty bright, some of us. But women are smart too. But there is an assigned role in the family, and that's what God says. And we accept it. Now, in verse 33, when it says, let the wife see that she fear her husband, that is, give him the proper respect. Of course, he's supposed to give her the proper respect, but she needs to be respectful to him in his role, because he's got a tough role. He's got a lot of decisions to make and a lot of things to do. Now, here's some advice in the form of proverbs. Advice, and we might give these things out as warnings to both men and women. Proverbs 14 and verse 1, every wise woman buildeth her house, but the foolish plucketh it down with her own hand. You know, they say that hell hath no fury than a woman, like a woman scorned, or something like that. But, you know, there are times when women make up their mind that they're going to mess things up, and they do make a good job of it. And sometimes the damage done cannot be repaired. Men can do that too, but sometimes women take a special glee in it. And so be careful. There are consequences for desperate times call for desperate measures, somebody says. Well, how desperate do you have to be? And how radical do we have to be to assert ourselves and our rights and all that kind of stuff? Just be careful. Proverbs 21 and verse 9. When I was a kid, we used to read this and laugh like it was funny. Ain't funny, McGee. It is better to dwell in the corner of the housetop than with a contentious woman in a wide house. When we were kids, that was funny. It ain't funny. Verse 19, it is better to dwell in the desert land than with a contentious and fretful woman. Proverbs 27 and verses 15 and 16, a continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. He that would restrain her restraineth the wind in his right hand and counteth oil. Once a woman's made up her mind, you know, she's pretty much made it up. And so we need to be careful. But a continual dropping in a very rainy day and a contentious woman are like Chinese water torture. And that's still funny to me. But anyway, there is a passage here that I think all women need to be familiar with. That's Proverbs 31, the whole chapter. But just two passages out of beginning in verse 10, a worthy woman who can find. For her price is far above rubies. The heart of her husband trusteth in her, and he shall have no lack of gain. She doeth him good and not evil all the days of her life. And you know what it goes on to describe? Her industriousness, her hard work, her using of common sense and extraordinary intelligence to bring praise to her husband through the things which she does. You ever heard somebody say about somebody who's married to a woman, man, he sure got lucky on that one. He sure is a lucky man. And there are some people who have hit the jackpot with the woman they picked out. And I think that any woman who tries is the jackpot, is worth whatever effort goes into supporting her. And not just supporting her physical needs, but also her emotional and spiritual needs. In verse 30 and 31 of Proverbs 31, grace is deceitful and beauty is vain. But a woman that feareth Jehovah, she shall be praised. Fellas, if your wife is a good Christian, I know what you need to be praying. I know what you need to be giving thanks for, because I know a lot of wives in the church who are not good Christians. And they're harmful, not only to themselves and their husbands, but also their children. They're not good Christians. And cast a shadow on their presence as mothers and wives when they're not. Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verses 3 through 7 addresses a problem that sometimes men and women have, but it addresses it kind of through the back door, so to speak. He says now in verse 3, let the husband render unto the wife her due, and likewise the wife also unto her husband. The wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one for another, except it be by consent for a season, that ye may give yourselves unto prayer and may be together again, that Satan tempt you not because of your incontinency. But this I say by way of concession, not of commandment. Yet I would that all men were even as myself, howbeit each man hath his own gift from God, one hath after this manner and another after that. When you attach yourself to somebody, you make sure that they're taken care of. You owe it to them because they can't go anywhere else. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 28, though, as we pointed out before, brings this idea of loving one another beyond the sexual relationship. If that's all there is, you ain't got much for a marriage. But there needs to be friendship. There needs to be concern. There needs to be agape love. And that's what is being talked about in Ephesians 5, again in verse 28, where he says, so ought husbands also to love their wives as their own bodies, and vice versa. Man loves himself, loves his wife, he loves himself. No man ever hate his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth, and goes both ways. And it compares that relationship to the relationship of Christ and the church. Now, what manner of parents ought we to be? Parents, some of us are a little bit old to be thinking about this maybe, but you think in terms of grandparents too. Or some of you who one day will be parents. Listen and learn and try to remember. Okay? One of these days. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, it says, "And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but nurture them in the chastening and the admonition of the Lord." The responsibility here is a double duty, isn't it? You to chasten and admonish your children in the Lord. Teach them what God wants. When you leave that out, you've left out the most important part of their education. It begins with, we'll say it begins with chastening or discipline, as we like to call it. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 7 and 8. There's a shocking word in here, but it's descriptive, and it's in the Bible. "It is for chastening that ye endure. God dealeth with you as with sons, for what son is there whom his father chasteneth not? Whereof all have been made partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. But if ye are without chastening," I left out a whole line, "whereof all have been made partakers, then ye are bastards and not sons." What does that mean? That means the person whose father does not discipline him, it's like he doesn't have a father, or might as well not have a father. Your father disciplines you. My father disciplined me. My father was mine and my brother's best friend growing up. But you know what? We had a healthy fear of him. We've talked about that plenty. Because he understood the need for punishment for wrongdoing. And let's look at some Proverbs. Proverbs 13 and verse 24, it says, "He that spareth his rod hateth his son." It's not he that spares the rod spoils the child. It's he that spares the rod hates the child. Why? Because he subjects him to temptations and problems and trials that may cost him his soul. He's not properly trained. It says, "He that loveth him chasteneth him betimes." Chapter 19 and verse 18, "Chasten thy son, seeing there is hope, and set not thy heart on his destruction." One of the problems a lot of parents have is that they want to be their child's friend and not their parent. And by doing so, they set their heart on his destruction. First, they are a child. They're your responsibility. "Chasten thy son, seeing there is hope." Direct him. Tell him what he needs to do and direct him that way. Now, if you're a child right now, this may sound a little bit odious, but one of these days you'll have children who will disappoint you if you don't do it. Worse than disappoint you. Break your heart. So, behave in such a way so that this doesn't have to be done. Proverbs 22 and verse 15, "Foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child." Now, you can see this exaggerate a little bit in little bitty kids. You turn loose of a little bitty kid out on the sidewalk, and he's going to dash for the street. Eventually. Just let him do whatever he wants to do. Sometimes you catch a son or a daughter in something that they ought not to be doing, and you're very disappointed. How do you react to it? You just coil back and say, "Well, can't stop them from doing that anyway. Might as well let them go ahead." Nope. "Foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him." Proverbs 23, verses 13 and 14, "Withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beat him with the rod, he will not die." My dad never beat me with a rod. He made me go cut a switch. A little bit later, you know, my mother used to use fly swatter. And she makes take down her pants, go lay across our beds when, you know, little kids. And then we'd have to wait for her to come in with the fly swatter. Well, my brother, he didn't like that. Well, I didn't like it either, but Dad came home and he says, "Dad, you'll never guess what Mother did." What? She spanked us with that dirty old fly swatter. It's got dead flies all over it. And she just spanked us with that, and it hurt real bad. And we got all messed up with those dirty old flies. And he says, Dee Dee, did you do that? She says, well, yeah. He says, well, don't you do that anymore. From now on, you just turn that fly swatter over. That was a sorry day. Okay, but withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beat him with the rod, he will not die. Thou shalt beat him with the rod and shalt deliver his soul from Sheol. What's Sheol? It's death, the place of the dead. Save his life. Well, we talk about punishment, but what about admonition? You know, I know parents that just punish the way out of their kids. They look for things to punish. But there's another side to that. You've got to teach them something too. There's a positive side to raising a child. In Proverbs 22 and verse 6, it says, train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart from it. Now, you know that that's a generality. There's some that are going to go bad no matter what you do. But generally speaking, if you train up a child in the way he should go, when he is old, he'll have some sense, and he'll come back to where he's been taught. Especially when he has some of his own. What is the old saying? The tree grows by the way you bend the twig or something like that. And somebody said that to my dad once, and he says, well, David, go cut a switch. We need to bend some twigs. So I went and cut a switch. But anyway, these passages emphasize the need to teach our children. You look at 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. How come Timothy was such a good young man? 2 Timothy 1 and verse 5 tells us. It says, having been reminded of the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded in thee also. And then in chapter 3 verses 14 and 15, he talks about the things that he had learned from a babe that was in the way of salvation. One of the most effective ways to teach your child how to do what's right, or your grandchild, got to bring myself into this, is to set a good example. It's, you know, it's real fine that you can bully your child into doing what you want him to do, but if you're asking him to do things that you refuse to do or live a way that you're not going to live. We used to have a neighbor when I was growing up in Maryvale, and he talked like a sailor. But if he ever heard his son curse, he'd beat him half to death for cursing. And he did it better. I was going to say he did a better job than his kid did. I mean, he knew all the words, and he used every one of them, didn't restrain himself in any of them. Well, what is he? He's a hypocrite. What should he be doing? He should be not using those words so that when the child utters them, he goes, oops. And he's not used to it. So, what does it say in Ephesians 5, verse 1? Be therefore imitators of God as beloved children. The reason Paul says that is because he knows, and the Holy Spirit knows, that children imitate their fathers. Now, if you know my son, you know he doesn't look anything like me. He doesn't. He's short. He's more heavy set than I am. And he has a continually, blissfully inane look on his face. He's happy about everything all the time. Okay, and where he gets that, I don't know. But I have people tell me all the time that John Paul did something that reminded me so much of you. Well, why? Not because we favor each other and our appearance or even our mannerisms, but he'll say something or do something that he's seen me do, and that's what people recall. Your children imitate you. I remember years ago, they had a commercial trying to get people to stop smoking, and they had this fella, and he kicking the can, his little boy's walking alongside him, kicking the can down the road. The little boy kicked the can, took off his coat, threw it over his shoulder. The little boy took off his coat, threw it over his shoulder. He went and sat down under a tree and leaned back against the tree. And the little boy did the same thing. And he pulled a cigarette out, and the little boy goes. And you get the point, don't you? That's the little kid's going to be a smoker when he gets. Why? Because he watched his dad smoke. Well, the point is that people imitate their parents. Children imitate their parents. So what greater service can you render your child than let your light shine before your child to set a good example? Do we set a good example for our children, our grandchildren, our nephews and nieces, or for younger members of the church? We need to do that. Now, to neglect in any of this is to be in violation of 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8, where he says, "But if any provideth not for his own, and especially his own household, he hath denied the faith, and is worse than an unbeliever." That provision, especially when we're talking about our wives and our children, involves physical needs, yes, of course, but it also involves spiritual needs. And I know that a lot of us turned out pretty good in spite of our parents, maybe. But how much easier is it if we got a good cheerleader, somebody who is anxious for us to do right, showing us the way? Now, what manner of children are we? Now, most of us here are old enough to be independent, but our responsibility as children is not ended when we grow up. Well, while we are at home, what's our obligation? Ephesians chapter 6 and verses 1 through 3. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth." Brother Elmer Cartwright lived to be 96 years old, was killed in a car wreck in December of 1974. And he was healthy as a horse. Couldn't see anything, but that was about his only problem. And he got interviewed in the newspaper all the time because the last 3 or 4 years of his life, he was the oldest living white native in Arizona. The only people out living in Arizona were Indians, and there was only one or two of those. And they're always asking him, "What's the secret of your long life?" And he would quote Ephesians 6 and verses 1 through 3. "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and thy mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth." There's a lesson there. Not just because he said it, but because it's the truth and it's something that we can observe. So, we look at some passages. Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 1, first of all, "A wise son heareth his father's instruction, but a scoffer heareth not rebuke." In other words, when your father corrects you, you just close your ears. Proverbs 15 and verse 20, "A wise son maketh a glad father, but a foolish man despiseth his mother." Now, if your father's a drunkard or if your father's an outlaw or something like that, of course, that's going to be the exception, but most of us don't have that for a father. So we need to be where God puts us. We need to be in subjection. And the idea of honoring our father and mother, look, it goes beyond just obedience as a child. Look at Mark chapter 7 and beginning in verse 8, where Jesus says, "Ye have heard the commandment of God and hold fast to the tradition of men," or "ye leave the commandment of God and hold fast to the tradition of men." And he said unto them, "Full well do you reject the commandment of God, that ye may keep your tradition. For Moses said, honor thy father and thy mother, and he that speaketh evil of father or mother, let him die the death. But ye say, if a man shall say to his father or his mother, that wherewith thou mightest have been profited by me is Corban, that is to say, given to God, ye no longer suffer him to do aught for his father or his mother, making void the word of God by your tradition." He includes in taking care of your older parents, he includes that in honoring your father and mother. There was an older woman in Glendale who shall remain nameless, who went to a rest home. And Somebody complained about people not going to see her, so one of the ladies over there bought a guest book and put it right at the entrance of her room so that people who came in would sign in. And guess whose name was conspicuously absent? It's the names of her children. But people in the church went and saw her. She had somebody there three or four times a week, minimum. Sometimes people have that disposition or attitude toward their parents that don't take care of them, especially when they get older. Proverbs 23 and verse 22, "Hearken to thy father that begat thee, and despise thy, not thy mother when she is old." My mother's old. She's 87. And she never thought she'd live that long. I got a chance to go see her next month, and I'm going to do it. She's just right around the corner from where I am. And I talk to her on the phone every now and then. She doesn't remember it, but sometimes she doesn't remember who I am. She'll say, "Now, are you David?" And I said, "Yeah." "Are you my son?" "Yeah." "Do I have any other children?" I say, "No." She says, "Good, I'll just write them out of the will." So I said, "Now you get it." Okay, Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 8. Children, listen to this, Connor and Maya. Aren't they cute? It says in Proverbs 1 and verse 8, "My son, hear the instruction of thy father and forsake not the law of thy mother." Okay. Chapter 3 and verses 1 through 4, "My son, forget not my law, but let thy heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace will they add unto thee. Let not kindness and truth forsake thee. Bind them about thy neck. Write them upon a tablet of thy heart. So thou shalt find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man." Now who's talking there? It's Solomon. He's talking to one of his sons. He's saying, "Listen to what I have to say. There's some wisdom there." I have to admit, again, there's not that kind of wisdom in all men. But you listen anyway and find whatever wisdom is there. And don't rebel. Where does wisdom start? Proverbs 1 and verse 7, "The fear of Jehovah is the beginning of knowledge, but the foolish despise wisdom and destruction." And instruction. They despise destruction too, but instruction as well. And then Proverbs 3 and verse 5, "Trust in Jehovah with all thy..." A good parent, that is the first rule they teach their children. "Trust in Jehovah with all thy heart and lean not upon thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he will direct thy paths. Be not wise in thine own eyes. Fear Jehovah and depart from evil. It will be health to thy navel and marrow to thy bones. Honor Jehovah with thy substance, with the first fruits of all thine increase. So shall thy barns be filled with plenty, and thy vats shall overflow with new wine." Acknowledge God, and he'll direct your paths. That's one of the first things my dad taught me. And it's been good for me from the very beginning. Well, in general terms, I just want to mention these without going over them a whole lot. But the kind of people that we ought to be are consecrated. We're told to offer our bodies a living sacrifice in Romans chapter 12, verse 1. In other words, we're to be devoted to God. We're to be pure and holy. Look at 1 John chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. 1 John chapter 3, verse 2 and 3, where it says, "Beloved, now are we the children of God. It is not yet made manifest what we shall be. We know that if he shall be manifested, we shall be like him, for we shall see him even as he is. And everyone that hath this hope set on him purifieth himself, even as he is pure." Now, somebody will say, "You know, God is the one who purifies us. He's the one who takes away sin." That's right. He's the one who forgives us of sins that we commit. And when he has done that, then we are responsible for keeping sin out of our lives. In that way, we purify ourselves. I mean, God forgives the sin. He takes away the sins that we commit. But the idea is not so that we can fill up the empty void with more sin. We have a responsibility too. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1, having therefore these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves. Let us cleanse ourselves? I thought only Jesus could cleanse us by his blood. Well, yeah, that's right. He's the only one that can cleanse us from sins that we have committed. But let us cleanse ourselves in the sense that we stop committing those sins. The idea that we don't have any responsibility in our own righteousness is of the devil and Calvin, not the cartoon character, the theologian. We're to be diligent. Romans chapter 12 and verse 11. Romans 12 and verse 11 says, in diligence, not slothful, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. How is your service to the Lord? We're to be faithful. We're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together, Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 25 says. We're to be loving as brethren. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16. Now, notice this is 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16 and not the Gospel of John 3. You know what John 3:16 says, for God so loved the world. But look at 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16 where it says, hereby know we love because he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoso hath the world's goods and beholdeth his brother in need and shutteth up his compassion from him, how doth the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word, neither with the tongue, but in deed and in truth. In Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10, we're to be ready to do good unto all men. And we're told in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, the golden rule, what we want others to do unto us, we're to do unto them first. Now, that is what we want them to do to us and for us. In Titus chapter 2 and verse 14, we're told that we have been redeemed so that we might be zealous of good works. In Philippians chapter 1 and verse 27, that zeal is borne out by a love for God and the gospel. It says, only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or be absent, I may hear of your state, that you stand fast in one spirit with one soul, striving for the faith of the gospel. The faith of the gospel is our preoccupation. It is what we live for. But not only is it born out of a love for the gospel and God himself, but our zeal is also born out of compassion for our neighbor. In Matthew chapter 3 and verse 36, it says, but when he, that is Jesus, saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were distressed and scattered as sheep, not having a shepherd. What better description is there for today's society than this one right here, Matthew 9:36? The problem is there aren't any shepherds. There are no shepherds. And so the sheep are scattered. Verse 37, then saith he unto his disciples, the harvest indeed is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of harvest that he send forth laborers into his harvest. I don't know how many people are here this morning, but I hope each and every one of you is a laborer for the Lord. You need to be. Why? Because we're to be zealous of good works. And we love the Lord. And we love our neighbor. And finally, people of the kind that they ought to be, that look forward to the end of time when the earth is going to be burned up and everything's going to be melted with fervent heat, are obedient people. Jesus says in Matthew 7, verse 21, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father who is in heaven. And the writer of Hebrews says of Jesus in Hebrews 5, verses 8 and 9, though he was a son, yet learned he obedience through the things which he suffered. And having been made perfect, he became unto all them that obey him, the author of eternal salvation. So these characteristics apply generally to what we're trying to get across. That is, what kind of people are the kind of people who look forward to and earnestly desire the coming of the day of God, which is the end of time. Now the question is, are you ready? If Jesus came today, what would happen to you? How would you greet that day? Well, the answer to this question, are you ready, is the same answer. If you're not ready, you're going to be in a world of hurt. If you are ready, then you can greet that day with joy and happiness. Are you the kind of person that you ought to be, that God wants you to be? Have you been obedient to his word? Have you been baptized into Christ? Now, there's no question that that's something that God requires of us, But we're baptized into Christ. We're not baptized into some fraternity or denomination or some man-built group. We're baptized into His body, the church, the one that you read about in the New Testament. Baptized into Christ. Galatians chapter 3, verses 26 and 27. If you haven't been, this is a time to take care of it. But if you have been baptized, it may be that you need to make some changes in your life so that you are the kind of person that you ought to be. And if we can help you in either one of those things, please make it known by coming to the front while we stand and sing.